I can be a winning Ryder Cup captain away, so is an exceptionally big deal, and it adds a lot to my legacy.
For the best Ryder Cup build-up reaction and exclusive interviews, go to otbsports.com/golfweekly and become an official friend of the pod now.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball,
brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
All right, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of Friday Night Racing on Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. We're starting off with some advice for you. Get a ticket for Bellewstown next Thursday. You don't want to miss this. All the money raised on the day goes to the Direct Aid for Africa charity that was founded by Barney Curley. Tickets are available to purchase on bellewstownraces.ie. Every race goer gets a commemorative race card. And the reason you should go is that the race on the day, in memory of Barney Curley specifically, has an absolutely stacked field. Jamie Spencer, Tom Queeley, Shane Kelly, and our guest this week, Frankie Dettori.
You're looking at riding me there. Horses. I was like, am I riding a Bellewstown?
Frankie Dettori, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm okay. You're making me nervous now.
I mean, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. This is your first time ever at Bellewstown, I'm told.
Yeah, it's the first time. I heard a lot about it, and I've been watching it, actually. I think you had a couple of meetings last week, so I did a little bit of homework, and I'm looking forward to come over and support the charity, celebrate Barney's life, and I'm bringing along some good jockeys with me. Well, they were under Barney's wings, and we'll make a day of it, and we'll celebrate lots of things.
One of the worst parts about COVID was that we didn't really get to have big funerals and celebrations and a proper Irish wake for people who passed away during it. And obviously racing had its fair share of people who passed away. And with Barney, there wasn't really a full opportunity for an outpouring of joy and celebration of his life.
Yeah, look, I saw him these last days, and look, the people who matters were there, his family and his close friends. But like you said, you could have filled five churches if everybody turned up. But, it's not the only funeral that it was low-key, but that's the way the world is at the moment.
What was he like, Frankie, actually, in these last days? It certainly was in my mind because, Barney had trained for the priesthood. He was quite a spiritual man for much of his life. And I guess when you know that the end is nearing, maybe you can take comfort in that. Was he able to talk to you and talk about how he was feeling?
Yeah, obviously, look, he was a very religious man. As you know, he started to be a priest, and then things didn't work out, but in his heart, it was always very close to God. And, he had a lot of illness in his life. And basically, when he got the cancer, and he knew this was the end, and, he said to me that it was at peace with the Lord, and he wasn't counting the days, but, he had faith on the Lord, and he was happy with himself. He deteriorated very quickly. His brain was intact until the last days. I mean, he was sharp as a razor, and we were reminiscing about the good days and about the things that he did, and we had a few laughs together. So, in one way, he passed away, of course. He suffered, but maybe not long, but that was maybe a good thing. But like I said, he told me that he was at peace with himself and at peace with the Lord. So he passed away, in comfort.
What were the good days as you reminisce about with him?
Oh, all sorts. I mean, I know him all my life, basically. Well, I know him since I was 16, and I was a bit of a tearaway. I mean, I'm not a saint now, but I was even worse then. I was a bit of a tearaway. So the advice used to give me, he used to have this great leather chair that it was like a confession box, basically. I used to sit there, and I used to give me advice and tell me the things I did wrong. And and we were just reminiscing about stories, obviously, told me about the telephone box of Yellow Sam. That's what I'm eager to see on next Thursday, the famous telephone box. And then we were watching the Irish Guinness together before he passed away. Wow. And then we were talking about horses, and then he said that throughout his training career, he was good friend with the Baron of Germany, and the Baron had this nice horse, then he had a bit of an injury, so he sent him to Barney's stud to give him some time off. I think he probably had about a year off. And then he started training this horse, and this horse was bombing up the gallops. So he was thinking of riding him in the Cambridgeshire, this German horse. And the guy who used to ride him, this Czech guy, he kind of turned around to Barney and said, "Barney, I think you want to send this horse to Mr. Faber because he's way too good for you." And the horse as such was called Manduro, what he won the Prince of Wales, won the Irish champion, he was favourite for the Ark. I mean, it would have been some coup if he ran in the Cambridgeshire, let me tell you. But that's how bad he used to think. So we were giggling about it in his last days. And he's an extraordinary man. He ran his own show. You know, I had the privilege to ride for him when I was young, but then obviously I was killing his prices because of my name, so I never wrote for him again.
He needed needed a less exotic name. Like, did you see that? Yeah. Did you get the sense, Frankie, that because he'd so tragically lost his son, that he became maybe a father figure to others by virtue of that?
Listen, I knew Charlie. He used to come to my house. I had a simulator horse, and he was a good amateur rider, so I used to teach him a few things. And Barney used to come along nicely. Yeah, it was a tragedy. I think he lost part of his life when Charlie went, and I think he was less active on the gambling side and more active on his charity. He was always a good man to other people before Charlie died. You know, he was a mentor to Declan Murphy and then myself, and then Shane, Spencer, Tom, I mean, and the list goes on and on and on. So it was a very giving man, and interesting, you know, yeah, very interesting. It's training, you know, you used to give horses numbers instead of names, so nobody knew which horse was what. He had great patience. He would turn the horse out for 2 years and then bring him back in training. People forgotten about it. And then he had the plan, and I never knew what was going on. And I just read it in the paper like everybody else the next day. You know, I mean, he would wait, and obviously Yellow Sam, one example, but, you know, I think it was about 10 years ago when he had four horses running on the same day in amateur races, and three have won. And one got beat, and he said to me, "Thank God the other one got beat, because I don't think the bookmakers had enough money to pay him out." So the treble enough was, I think, was worth over 2 million or something. So it was a remarkable man. And he did it all himself. He trained them. Of course, he had assistant trainers and lads, but he trained them, he looked after them, he bought them himself. He trained for a couple for Patsy Burns, obviously. But in fairness, most of the horses that he had were his. He paid the staff, so it was a one-man band, and he was very, very successful at it.
Can you take us back to the very start? How did you meet him, and what was it like when you got under his wing at the start?
Well, I went to a night out in my town, and I came back after a few drinks, and I came back. I turned the TV on, and I think it was about midnight, and it was this program called After Dark on a Saturday. And listen, in those days, only four channels. So I watched it, and it was him, McQuarrie, Ross Scott, some lady, I can't remember, it was four or five, and they're all arguing about racing and this and that, bookmakers. And Barney sat in this room, he never said a word. And then the last time, 10 minutes, he held court and he shut everybody up, and he was so fascinated. I thought, well, I'd love to meet this guy. And it was, I think the next week I went to the sales in Newmarket, and I saw this figure with a tree on me, and obviously it was Barney. And I was a magnet to him. I went straight to him. I didn't know what I was going to tell him. Anyway, I looked him up, and he looked at me, said, "Hello, Lanfranco." And I was surprised that he knew my name, because I was 16. I only just started riding. And he said to me, "Listen, I've been watching you riding. I like you. So do you know the word omerta in Italian, you know, like you?" I said, "Yes, I do. Yes, I do, Mr. Curley." He said, "Right, if I ring you, you won't tell anyone. I'm going to put you on some horses in the apprentice race." I said, "Fine." And sure to know, 2 or 3 weeks later, he rings me. He said, "Tell no one, your agent or no one, but I'm going to put you on this horse at Folkestone in this apprentice race." And so I had to make some sort of lie to my agents. You know, "I've got another ride in the race. Don't bother with this." Anyway, sure to know, the day before the races, my name was stuck down on this horse. So Barney, I looked him up in the paper. This horse didn't run for 800 days. That's about 2.5 years. And I said, "Listen," he rang me. He said, "Listen, I'm not going. Declan is going to be there with you. All I want you to do is not win more than half a length." He said, "Is there?" I said, "I don't care what you do. I don't want you to be more than half a length." And true to be known, I strangled this horse around Folkestone, and I won by a neck. I mean, I was basically at both feet of the dashboard, trying to pull these horses back. And nothing. 2 days later, he called me. We had a game of snooker. He said, "Job well done." And then he stopped me on another one at Kempton, and same thing happened. Those bolted up. And then the third time we tried it again, his horse was slashed to ridiculous prices. And then he sat me. He didn't sat me. He said, "Listen, you're not good to me anymore." and that's how we started. And then obviously he was fond of me. So I used to go around his house and play snooker. And we used to chat about life. And then, yeah, obviously his son. And then after the tragedy, we swapped houses, basically. I was just about to get married and starting a family. So he went to my little cottage and I went to his big house. That's it. That is, you know, we went on holidays together. And then he started the Daffa charity. I'm quite ashamed that I never went actually to Zambia. But Barney said that I wouldn't have the guts to survive it. Johnny went, Johnny Murta, also a good friend of Barney, and I met some of the volunteers, priests, and Andrew Montague was the solicitor, lawyer of the charity, and so I know most of the team, and a remarkable job really from nothing. They managed to build hospices, hospitals, and now schools. A sort of thing in 25 years to, you know, something really great. And that's why we are having a day on Thursday.
It sounds like there's just a genuine warmth between you from the very start. For how important was it for you to have somebody who kind of looked out for you a little bit, it sounds like, as well, when you were 16 and a bit of a tearaway, and somebody you could kind of trust who was a bit older to kind of say, you know, it's okay to have a night out every now and again, but maybe not every night.
Not that, you know. I had a very colorful and roller coaster life. So, you know, he would put your arm around me, he would tell me the mistake that I did, and he would, kick you up the backside if you did something wrong. But you know, overall, he had a good heart, and he would, you know, he would say the right thing at the right time when somebody was low, when somebody was who needed one. And it was always there for me. So of course, we share the same passion, horse racing, and we talked about it all the time. But we never kind of, you know, I never knew what was going on, and in his operation. But you know, I would go in the winter to ride out a little bit for him just to get myself fit, because I knew that he was a friend, and I knew that he didn't mind. But,
And can I ask
apart from that,
Frankie, were there many people in your life who you would take advice from, or like a kick in the ass from, or an arm around the shoulder? Because, you know, like, you guys who make the very top in sport, you're competitive, and, you know, you don't always take feedback in a positive way. There's not many people, I would suspect, who you would trust to give you feedback, positive or negative.
But listen, I came to England when I was 14, and I didn't have my parents. Of course, my parents were a phone call away, but I didn't have anyone physically here to kind of to guide me or tell me what was right, what was wrong. So it was, you know, he was always there for me. And, you know, so it was like a father figure to me. And it, you know, it was there till the very end. And so it was always somebody that I could turn to and ask him for advice. And he was a great man, you know, and I was one of many. You know, it wasn't just me. I was one of many that he touched lives, and that's why it was so popular.
That part of his life is something that I think only has really emerged afterwards. Certainly for the general public, the story of Barney Curley is the story of Yellow Sam and the story of Belliestown. But actually, it's a much bigger life than that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, and you see on Thursday the people that turn out because, I mean, he was a character. You know, he had the amazing one-liners. Yeah, you know, if you see him walking around, you think he didn't have two bobs put together, and you know, but you know, he had it was not about the money. It was about life. It was about behavior, about giving, you know, like his famous book, Give Something Back. You know, it was always looking out for people. And that's why it was so special.
And that's the interesting thing, Frankie, because like a lot of people, they make money, but not necessarily to be wealthy. They make money for different reasons. Barney pulled off these coups, sometimes because he was broke and actually did need the money, but other times he did it for the kick and for the enjoyment of beating the bookmaker. And from Yellow Sam, which was obviously turned into a movie, but then as you mentioned, this idea of the multiple bets, which all of a sudden you have astronomical odds. Charles Burns tried to copycat him. I know another punter in Ireland now who's also teetotal like Barney and is constantly trying to plot, but they don't necessarily live these really, really you know, glamorous lives. It's more almost for the kick of it and for the enjoyment of beating the bookmaker.
Yeah, I would say that's quite right. You know, and he also liked to do it without cheating. You know, he was doing things above the law, you know what I mean? And, you know, it took great patience and great planning, especially when you do it all by yourself, not to let the cat out of the bag before. You know, otherwise the price would be slashed. So that was part of his life. That was part of his makeup. But that did not interfere on his kindness and his religion and his way of helping people. There were two different Barneys that I knew, and it was quite fascinating that I was, you know, all these years I was been around that. And. And, you know, I never saw the gambling side on him because I mean, that didn't quite interest me. But yeah, but it's amazing when you look back all the things that he managed to do in racing, and, you know, go even with the winners he had the Galway, and many more that they've gone under the radar without his name. So it's amazing, man.
Yeah, and like I think, I guess in racing in particular, you know, you can't see the wood from the trees at times because it's just race, 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 day in, day out. Like, there's almost no sport where you're literally almost racing every day if you want to as a jockey. And Barney, he did have this idea, maybe after Charlie, that there is more to life than this and we can actually help people in other parts of the world who are far less fortunate than we are.
Yeah, look, I told me many times, you know, prior to Charlie's death, you know, you know, if he had a car, he wanted a bigger car. Yeah, if he had a house, he wanted a bigger house. He was forever kind of chasing his tail, and then obviously that tragedy, you know, it kind of changed it. You know, it's not about, you know, obviously you need to have goals in life, but he got to a point that he thought he had achieved enough, and he just wanted to give something back, and you know, and obviously all his friends then stayed in church and became priests. He was always very close to them, and they were missionary in Africa, and so he decided to get involved, and he knew he could raise money, and he started Dafa Charity. I was 30 years ago, I was on a whip suspension for a few days, and he said, look, I'll take you with me to a retreat in Galway with the priests. I thought, this is going to go down well. I'm religious, but I'm not that religious. So we boarded on the plane, we arrived in Galway, and actually the retreat is opposite the race course. It was no race, it was like middle of May or something. And you know, and I had my own little room, and obviously with all these priests meditating and, you know, doing their stuff. And, you know, I was pretty much in my room and reading the paper and having a cup of tea. And then towards the evening, Barney said, all right, we're going to go to the pub and have something to eat with the priests. I said, fine. And before you know, after a couple of guineas, the guitars were out, everybody was singing. This is much more fun than I thought. even they enjoy themselves and they have a laugh, you know. And but at the end of the day, they are religiously, and they do a lot of things for other people, and that's why this stuff came out, and it was a creation of Barney, basically, with the help of his fellow priests.
And getting on to Belluestown, I do remember when you came to Killarney, maybe a couple of years ago now, it was just amazing, the power, because I find in Ireland, horses don't necessarily sell tickets as much as they should. It's almost like we're so used to good horses here now that there isn't as much of a novelty, but you were a novelty, and I guess as much as it will be about Barney, you are a big draw on Belluestown next week.
Yeah, well, I spoke to my fellow jockeys in Ireland. They said Killarney is like Royal Ascot compared to Belluestown, so they kind of frightened me a bit. Listen, I'm not really there of course I'm there to race and try to win, but I'm there to have a fun day out, to remember Barney and give the Dafa Charity a bit of a plug, make sure that people come to the races and have a good time, sign a few autographs, and have a jolly day. So I'm looking forward to it. It's a challenge, it's something new, and something that I like to do things like that. You know, like when I went to Killarney, I like to think outside the box a bit and not just doing the same mundane thing. I go to the tracks than I usually go. So it'd be a fun day.
Are days like this important now for you to keep you interested? And not apart from Barney, but like something entirely new, like Belluestown or like Killarney. Because at this stage of your career, there has to be something new that gets you out of bed and going, right, I'm chasing something else.
Yeah, I do. You know, when a challenge is put in front of me, I like to, before I would say I'd be afraid of doing it. Now I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm 50. What's the point? You know, if the chance arrives, I take it. You know, because I won't have many other chances in later life. So anything was thrown in front of me, I usually nowadays I take it.
How are you looking so well, actually?
Yeah.
For 50, I think I took the words out of Jerry's mouth. Do you drink the finest of Italian wine, or is it just riding good horses, or what is it?
In good genes, I'll be honest with you. I think my parents. And look, I think doing something that you love helps a lot. Doing something with a smile on your face helps a lot. I think stress is the biggest killer. A lot of people in this world work because they have to work, but they don't actually like what they do. But I'm blessed since day one. I've been in this sport. I love horses. I love the racing, I love the smell of the crowd, I love the competition, and I think that's what kept me going for so long.
And I've said this to Jerry a few times on the show, Frankie, that, you know, we fall into parts of our life that become our life, essentially. So Frankie Dettori, like, you know, there aren't many Italian jockeys, but you became a jockey. It was because your dad was from Sardinia and he was a jockey, and then you became arguably the most famous jockey in the world. But you probably did that because your dad was a jockey.
I did that because, well, two things. First of all, you know, like any Italian kid, I wanted to be a footballer.
Yeah.
I was okay. I wasn't, but then between the age of 8 and 9, all my mates grew a foot and I didn't. So I was getting kicked all over the park. So the plan B was, because I was riding ponies and stuff, though, I wanted to be a jockey because, you know, I liked that life. But then I didn't realize that I was going to be this good. And by all kind of fell in by chances. You know, I came to England to learn, and Kumani took good liking on me, and then he taught me a lot, and then the whole thing stumbled out of what I still think that I never realized this was going to happen to my life. So, you know, I had every intention to become a jockey and to do well, but not, I didn't, in my wildest dream, I thought I was going to be this good.
You mentioned the good genes, right? Is the story about your dad's mucking out stables and being asked to ride a horse that was unrideable, is that true? Was that his first experience of being a jockey?
So basically, well, what happened was when you were apprentices, you signed 5 years to a trainer. And dad never sat on a horse, so all he was made to do is sweep the yard and muck out. And they had this crazy horse next door stable that only this guy was able to ride, but this guy didn't turn up for a couple of days. He was sick or something. So the trainer was so desperate to get this horse out and get him exercised that my dad stupidly he volunteered to ride his horse because he watched people ride, you know, for months, but he was never sat on the horse. And I guess because this crazy horse felt that my dad was incapable of riding, he was quiet, and he lobbed him around the track once. And the trainer was so excited. He said, well, just take him round again. And but I think the reason for that horse was calm is because my father couldn't ride. Because everybody else was used to ride his horse. They used to bully him. And this horse used to get mad. So that's how he started, really.
Well, my theory, that kind of blows my theory up. Because my theory was your dad was obviously an innate horseman. There was something inside him that was great. But actually, it was just his calmness.
Correct. And, you know, horse has a sixth sense, you know. I guess this horse didn't want it to be bullied, and my father was unable to bully a horse because he wasn't able to ride, and this horse was like calm.
And so is that your gift? Is that the genetics that you inherited from your dad, that you actually can feel what the horse needs?
Well, mom, she used to work in a circus, and she did everything. She stood on two horses together and gallop around the circus square, the ring. And she was very supple, and so a bit of combination, you know, my dad physically and my mom's suppleness. And I mean, be a horseman is because I've been around horses all my life. And you know, Luca was always telling me when I was a kid, you have to find the key of every horse because every horse is different. So he used to challenge me by putting me on different type of horses every day, and it worked.
It definitely worked. So in your head, these experiences this week, are they the things that are keeping you going, or are you just going to keep going until you don't enjoy it anymore? Is there a clock in your head about when you might stop?
I'll be honest with you, when I was 30, I said I'll stop at 40. When I was 40, I said I'll stop at 50. And I'm 50 now and I'm still going. So I really don't know. Look, nowadays, with the dietitians, with the physios, and you know, in every sport, everybody goes longer. Tennis, football, and I mean, I remember when I started. I mean, 50 was the magical age of retiring. I mean, Mick retired at 51, my dad 51, Lester retired at 49, came back at 56, Pat retired at 50. So by nowadays, you know, if I can squeeze 3 or 5 years, be great. As you know, in my sport, you always one fall away from stopping, so I can't help that. But I take good care of myself. I train every day. And, you know, the most important thing is as long as you got that fire in your belly that you still want to do it, I will do it. And I'm tremendously enjoy what I do. It's no better feeling when I go racing. You have, you know, 20 or 30,000 people shouting your name when you ride a favorite. It's tremendous. I mean, it's like a drug. You don't want to let go. And you know, it took me over 30 years to get to this position, and now I'm enjoying it.
So the crowds coming back must be something you're feeding off.
Oh, it's amazing. You don't realize. So I went to Canada last weekend, and they're still under lockdown. And what a difference, because we now almost back to normal in this country. So the last 6 weeks, I've been able to enjoy a full crowd like we did at York, or like we got Newmarket. So we already got used to have the crowd back, but it was, you know, it was a culture shock to go back to what we were like when I went to Canada. So hopefully you guys are on the way out. I've seen that you got crowds coming back, and make sure you get to Ballingstan on Thursday. I'm waiting for you.
Are you going to win?
Of course. Right. I'm coming down to lose, isn't I?
That's our tip then this week. Back Frankie Dettori on Thursday in Ballingstan. Frankie, you've been great with your time. Thanks a million for joining us.
Okay, take care. I'll see you Thursday. Bye.
Bye, bye, bye. That's the inimitable Frankie Dettori there. Inimitable in racing and jockey terms, but I think that, like, I certainly have a much fuller picture of Barney Curley after that conversation. Like, we did really good conversation about Barney Curley when we were doing our Mount Rushmore, because he was nominated but then didn't actually make the final cut. But now in retrospect, I think I could go back and say, well, actually there's a fuller life here as a mentor,
yeah,
as a character who influences, I mean, maybe in the style of Forrest Gump, but like, is there for, I'd never heard a connection between Barney Curley and Declan Murphy before, for example. Like, maybe it's a coincidence, and maybe we only hear about the ones who end up having these incredible careers and being champion jockey or vying for champion jockey. But like, you look at the names who are coming over that he's been involved with: Jamie Spencer, Tom Creeley, Shane Kelly, Frankie Dettori, coming over just for this race. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah, well, often, like, I suppose when you read the profile of a person in the Sunday paper, it's a better description and version of that person than if you interviewed the person, particularly if the person is like Barney, whose whole MO was on people knowing as little about him as possible, really, such that he ditched Frankie after, what did he say, three rides? Because
you're not good to me anymore.
Lanfranco Dettori is like quite a, you know, he was probably El Dettori in those days, but there wouldn't have been many Dettoris riding. So if Barney lands two gambles and horses that are hard held and El Dettori is riding the third time, fool me once, shame on you and all that. But he was a remarkable man. Like, Ger, he trained, by and large, he trained rubbish, or he trained crocs that he got back to some sort of ability. And I'm not going to lie, I mean, I'd have some misgivings about, you know, how erratic his horses ran. They'd go from, like, run to 40 to run to 100 nearly in the space of, like, one run. But he did everything.
Those runs could be 800 days apart, though.
Exactly, he did things within the rules. Bookmakers, I think, are running scared of taking bets on horse racing, or certainly multiples now, more or less ever since his first one. Because if you have, like, three or four horses who are, say, And remember, Barney was involved in one of these coups where the horses weren't actually trained by him, or certainly not on the race card anyway. And I'm not suggesting that the other trainers didn't train them, but like, there was no suggestion that the bookmakers would know there was any connection to Barney at all. And that's the real that's the real one, that
unknown.
And you see, like, all these copycats now, like, that's what intrigues me, because, like, a lot of racing is most racing is very run of the mill, it's rudimentary. But when you can get like bad racing, but these coups are going on to essentially rob very wealthy bookmakers of a lot of money, anyone will tell you, like, on the Racing Post website or whatever it is, they're the stories that people click into. And it's not clickbait, it's people are really interested in these gambles, and an awful lot of that is due to Barney Curley, Yellow Sam, and the subsequent gambles that he pulled off.
Okay, so Ballingstan this Thursday. Tickets are available to purchase ballingstanraces.ie. Everybody gets a commemorative race card, and it is all raising money it's obviously in memory of Barney Curley and his Direct Aid for Africa charity that was founded. So as I said, Jamie Spencer, Tom Creeley, Shane Kelly and Frankie Dettori going up against the best Irish jockeys in that race. I want to give you the full name of the actual race itself so I can where's the details of the actual name of the race here? It is the 20,000 Gannon's City Recovery and Recycling Services Limited, supporting DAFA Handicap. So, and that's Direct Aid for Africa Handicap. And it is this Thursday in Ballyston. I think there's still some tickets available, and or during the week, sponsors were still able to sponsor saddle cloths if that was one way that you wanted to give to the charity as well. That would be great as well. So ballytownraces.ie. Friday Night Racing is brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. How do you follow that, Johnny?
Yeah, just I suppose another charity to mention, which involves Ballytown, the Coast to Curra cycle.
Oh, you did
tomorrow.
The cycle? It's tomorrow.
Yeah, so I think Ballytown is one of the...
Starts at 7 o'clock there?
Starts at 7. I think it starts at Laytown, does it?
And oh, then, Laytown, sorry.
And then it takes in various kind of studs and race courses, Nace, Ballytown, ends up in the Curra and so forth. I think there will be a couple of special guests to welcome the stragglers and so forth after 155k. I'm sure there'll be a lot of straggling, but to welcome them back to the Curra before a very good car tomorrow. And Gavin Lynch is doing that, has kind of organised that charity I guess it's kind of around Pat Mullen's anniversary and so forth, and it's for pancreatic cancer research, and it's a very worthwhile cause. I know there are some people who probably shouldn't be let out, not to mind, on a bike, willing to participate tomorrow, some of whom I know. So, you know, support them and go to the GoFundMe page, because it's not that easy to ride a bike. Especially around Ballytown, which is quite hilly.
155 kilometres, it's a bit tricky as well. Right, let me tell you about the tote 10 to follow. Unfortunately, things have taken a turn for the worse here from my perspective. If Search for a Song makes a quick reappearance on Sunday at the Curra, where she's down to run, you may well be able to grow your lead over me. Next weekend sees the biggest potential for a change in the Tote 10 to follow standings as the big names in all our stables head to Paris for the Prix de l'Arc. Tote would like to remind everyone the Tote jackpot is back. To play the jackpot, you pick the winners in races 3 to 6. You can play the jackpot at any Irish race meeting and on tote.ie. Tom Malone leads. It's not a massive... It's not the kind of... We're all, like, wake... in his wake lead that it was for a while. It's only 82 points over you, and then you're 13 points ahead of me, so
narrowing the gap. Yeah, it's going to ask Frankie who's going to win the arc, but you kind of ended the conversation. He's ridden Snowfall, and he's obviously, like, even at his age, he's riding some unbelievable horses, and
yeah, so
he'll keep him all day, because he's like, his relationship with kind of riding for Aidan O'Brien now and so forth is interesting. Rides a bit for Aidan, his relationship with other jockeys and all that, and yeah.
Those trainers aren't, and those owners aren't putting him on horses because they like the name and they want a bit of celebrity. They want him to win, right?
Let's say some people would still consider him literally the best, like at 50. You know, Ryan Moore is obviously there, but yeah, British racing is probably without star young riders at the moment. Colin Keane is the best we have. But yeah, I mean, if you canvass trainers, a lot of them would still say Frankie's the best, which is some going at 50, like, you know. It's a great thing about racing as well, that you can go that strong. He mentioned Pat Edery, the late Pat Edery, Mick Kinnan, and Lester, who obviously came back. But
I didn't realise it was 7 years, or was it 6 years, whatever he said between there.
56 was it? He came back to ride Royal Academy for Vincent O'Brien, obviously, in the Breeders' Cup, which was incredible. But yeah, Frankie, 50. It's not like I think Davy Russell's comeback, I think, is remarkable, because he's a jumps jockey. I think Davy's 42, and that's a lot more laudable than riding in your 50s on the flat, because you don't have that many falls. Frankie just looks in great shape. He's probably not riding as much, like, low-grade stuff, because you have to, maybe less is more as you get older. And that's why it's special to have him at Ballytown. And, you know, I think these events, when Pat Mullen's fundraiser at the Curra had all these ex-jockeys riding, and there was obviously Tony McCoy and Ruby and Carberry and all that came back, there was amazing buzz. But Ireland really, really loves Frankie Dettori. Like, it'll just sell out, simple as. And it'll be massive... it'll be all over the papers. Like, it gets racing on the papers because it's Frankie.
Oh, no, totally. And if he wins, he'll do the jump, but everybody will be like, Ballytown will be aflame. So that's the place to be this coming Thursday, ballytownraces.ie for tickets. That is this week's Friday Night Racing in the books. We'll talk about the racing in more detail next week, obviously. Friday Night Racing on Off the Ball. It's brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. See you next week.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.